Sometimes that was enough, and sometimes it wasn't. We had to rotate troops back to Bane, or even further, just for them to recover from what HQ liked to think of as bouts of mass hysteria or madness. I wasn't a charter mage then, but I was going with patrols into the Old Kingdom, beginning to learn. On one patrol, we met a man sitting by a charter stone on top of a hill that overlooked both the wall and the perimeter. As he was obviously interested in the perimeter, the officer in charge of the patrol thought we should question him and kill him if he turned out to bear a corrupted charter or was some free magic thing in the shape of a man. But we didn't, of course. It was Ab Horsen, and he was coming to us because he'd heard about the dead. We escorted him in, and he met with the general commanding the garrison. I don't know what they agreed, but I imagine it was for Ab Horsen to bind the dead, and in return, he was to be granted citizenship of Anselstier and freedom to cross the wall. He certainly had the two passports after that. In any case, he spent the next few months carving the wind flutes you can see among the wire. "Ah!" exclaimed Sabriel. "I wondered what they were. Wind flutes. That explains a lot." "I'm glad you understand," said the colonel. "I still don't. For one thing, they make no sound, no matter how hard the wind blows through them. They have charter symbols on them I'd never seen before he carved them, and have never seen again anywhere else. But when he started placing them, one a night, the dead just gradually disappeared, and no new ones rose." They reached the far end of the parade ground, where another scarlet sign stood next to a communication trench, proclaiming, "Perimeter Garrison HQ. Call and wait for sentry." A telephone handset and a bell chain proclaimed the usual dichotomy of the perimeter. Colonel Horis picked up the handset, wound the handle, listened for a moment, then replaced it. Frowning, he pulled the bell chain three times in quick succession. "Anyway," he continued, as they waited for the sentry, "whatever it was, it worked. So we are deeply indebted to Ab Horsen, and that makes his daughter an honored guest.
I may be less honored and more reviled as a messenger of ill omen," said Sabriel quietly. She hesitated, for it was hard to talk about Ab Horsen without tears coming to her eyes, then continued quickly to get it over and done with.
"The reason I am going into the Old Kingdom is to look for my father. Something has happened to him."
"I had hoped there was another reason for you to carry his sword," said Horis.
He moved the skis into the crook of his left arm, freeing his right, to return the salute of the two sentries who were running at the double up the communication trench, hobnails clacking on the wooden slats.
"There is worse, I think," added Sabriel,
taking a deep breath to stop her voice from breaking into sobs.
"He is trapped in death. Or he may even be dead, and his bindings will be broken."
"The wind flutes?" asked Horis, grounding the end of the skis, his salute dying out halfway to his head. "All the dead here?"
"The flutes play a song only heard in death," replied Sabriel, "continuing a binding laid down by Ab Horsen. But the bound are tied to him, and the flutes will have no power if... They will have no power if Ab Horsen is now among the dead. They will bind no more."
Chapter 3
"I am not one to blame a messenger for her tidings," said Horis, as he handed a cup of tea over to Sabriel,
who was sitting on what looked like the only comfortable chair in the dugout which was the colonel's headquarters.
"But you bring the worst news I have heard for many years."
"At least I am a living messenger, and a friendly one," Sabriel said quietly.
She hadn't really thought beyond her own concern for her father. Now she was beginning to expand her knowledge of him, to understand that he was more than just her father, that he was many different things to different people.
her simple image of him, relaxing in the armchair of her study at Wyverley College, chatting about her schoolwork, Anselstier technology, charter magic and necromancy, was a limited view, like a painting that only captured one dimension of the man.
"How long do we have until Abhorsen's bindings are broken?"
asked Horiz, breaking into Sabriel's remembrance of her father. The image she had of her father reaching for a teacup in her study disappeared, banished by real tea slopping over in her enamel mug and burning her fingers.
"Oh, excuse me, I wasn't thinking. How long till what?"
"The binding of the dead,"
the colonel reiterated patiently.
"How long till the bindings fail, and the dead are free?"
Sabriel thought back to her father's lessons, and the ancient grimoire she had spent every holiday slowly memorizing. The Book of the Dead, it was called, and parts of it still made her shudder. It looked innocuous enough, bound in green leather, with tarnished silver clasps. But if you looked closely, both leather and silver were etched with charter marks. Marks of binding and blinding, closing and imprisonment. Only a trained necromancer could open that book, and only an uncorrupted charter mage could close it. Her father had brought it with him on his visits, and always took it away again at the end. "It depends," she said slowly, forcing herself to consider the question objectively, without letting emotion interfere. She tried to recall the pages that showed the carving of the wind flutes, the chapters on music and the nature of sound in the binding of the dead.
If Abhorsen is truly dead, the wind flutes will simply fall apart under the light of the next full moon. If he is trapped before the ninth gate, the binding will continue until the full moon after he passes beyond, or a particularly strong spirit breaks the weakened bonds.
"So the moon will tell, in time," said Horiz. "We have 14 days till it is full."
"It is possible I could bind the dead anew," Sabriel said cautiously. "I mean, I haven't done it on this sort of scale, but I know how. The only thing is, if Father isn't beyond the ninth gate, then I need to help him as soon as I can. And before I can do that, I must get to his house and gather a few things, check some references."
"How far is this house beyond the wall?" asked Horiz, a calculating look on his face.
"I don't know," replied Sabriel.
"What?"
"I don't know. I haven't been there since I was about 4. I think it's supposed to be a secret. Father had many enemies, not just among the dead. Petty necromancers, free magic sorcerers, witches."
"You don't seem disturbed by your lack of directions," interrupted the colonel dryly.
For the first time, a hint of doubt, even fatherly condescension, had crept into his voice, as if Sabriel's youth undermined the respect due to her as both a charter mage and necromancer. "Father taught me how to call a guide who will give me directions," replied Sabriel coolly. "And I know it's less than 4 days' travel away." That silenced Horiz, at least for the moment. He nodded, and standing cautiously, so his head didn't hit the exposed beams of the dugout, he walked over to a steel filing cabinet that was rusting from the dark brown mud that oozed between the pale planks of the revetment. Opening the cabinet with a practiced heave of considerable force, he found a mimeographed map and rolled it out on the table.
"We've never been able to get our hands on a genuine old kingdom map. Your father had one, but he was the only person who could see anything on it. Just looked like a square of calfskin to me. A small magic, he said, but since he couldn't teach it, perhaps not so small. Anyway, this map is a copy of the latest version of our patrol map. So it only goes out about 10 miles from the crossing point. The garrison's standing orders strictly forbid us to go further. Patrols tend not to come back beyond that distance. Maybe they desert, or maybe..."
His tone of voice suggested that even nastier things happened to the patrols, but Sabriel didn't question him.
A small portion of the old kingdom lay spread out on the table, and once again, excitement stirred up within her.
"We generally go out along the old north road," said Horis, tracing it with one hand, the sword calluses on his fingers rasping across the map like the soft sandpapering of a master craftsman. "Then the patrols sweep back, either southeast or southwest, till they hit the wall. Then they follow that back to the gate."
"What does this symbol mean?" asked Sabriel, pointing to a black tin square atop one of the farther hills.
"That's a charter stone," replied the colonel, "or part of one now. It was riven in two, as if struck by lightning, a month or so ago. The patrols have started to call it Cloven Crest, and they avoid it if possible. Its true name is Bar Hedrin Hill, and the stone once carried the charter for a village of the same name. Before my time, anyway. If the village still exists, it must be further north, beyond the reach of our patrols. We never had any reports of inhabitants from it coming south to Cloven Crest. The fact is, we have few reports of people, full stop. The garrison log used to show considerable interaction with Old Kingdom people, farmers, merchants, travellers, and so on. But encounters have become rarer over the last 100 years, and very rare in the last 20. The patrols would be lucky to see even 2 or 3 people a year now. Real people, that is, not creatures or free magic constructs or the dead. We see far too many of those."
"I don't understand," muttered Sabriel. "Father often used to talk of villages and towns, even cities in the Old Kingdom. I remember some of them from my childhood. Well, I sort of remember, I think."
"Further into the Old Kingdom, certainly," replied the colonel. "The records mention quite a few names of towns and cities. We know that the people up there call the area around the wall the Borderlands, and they don't say it with any fondness."
Sabriel didn't answer, bending her head lower over the map, thinking about the journey that lay ahead of her. Cloven Crest might be a good waypoint. It was no more than 8 miles away, so she should be able to ski there before nightfall if she left fairly soon, and if it wasn't snowing too hard across the wall. A broken charter stone did not bode well, but there would be some magic there, and the path into death would be easier to tread. Charter stones were often erected where free magic flowed, and crossroads of the free magic currents were often natural doorways into the realm of death. Sabriel felt a shiver inch up her spine at the thought of what might use such a doorway, and the tremor passed through to her fingers on the map. She looked up suddenly and saw Colonel Horis looking at her long, pale hands, the heavy paper of the map still shuddering at her touch. With an effort of will, she stilled the movement.
"I have a daughter, almost your age," he said quietly. "Back in Corvair with my wife, I would not let her cross into the Old Kingdom."
Sabriel met his gaze, and her eyes were not the uncertain, flickering beacons of adolescence. "I'm only 18 years old on the outside," she said, touching her palm against her breast with an almost wistful motion. "But I first walked in death when I was 12. I encountered a 5th gate rester when I was 14, and banished it beyond the 9th gate. When I was 16, I stalked and banished a mordicant that came near the school, a weakened mordicant, but still. A year ago, I turned the final page of the Book of the Dead. I don't feel young any more."
"I'm sorry for that," said the colonel.
Then, almost as if he had surprised himself, he added,
"Oh, I mean that I wish you some of the foolish joys my daughter has, some of the lightness, the lack of responsibility that goes with youth. But I don't wish it if it will weaken you in the times ahead. You have chosen a difficult path."
"Does the walker choose the path, or the path the walker?" Sabriel quoted, the words redolent with echoes of charter magic, twining around her tongue like some lingering spice. Those words were the dedication in the front of her almanac. They were also the very last words
all alone on the last page of the Book of the Dead.
"I've heard that before," remarked Horace. "What does it mean?"
"I don't know," said Sabriel.
"It holds power when you say it," added the Colonel slowly.
He swallowed, open-mouthed, as if the taste of the charter marks was still in the air.
"If I spoke those words, that's all they would be. Just words."
"I can't explain it," Sabriel shrugged and attempted a smile. "But I do know other sayings that are more to the point at the moment, like, traveller, embrace the morning light, but do not take the hand of night. I must be on my way."
Horace smiled at the old rhyme, so beloved of grandmothers and nannies, but it was an empty smile. His eyes slid a little away from Sabriel's, and she knew that he was thinking about refusing to let her cross the wall. Then he sighed, the short, huffy sigh of a man who is forced into a course of action through lack of alternatives.
"Your papers are in order," he said, meeting her gaze once again. "And you are the daughter of Abhorsen. I cannot do other than let you pass. But I can't help feeling that I'm thrusting you out to meet some terrible danger. I can't even send a patrol out with you, since we have 5 full patrols already out there."
"I expected to go alone," replied Sabriel. She had expected that, but felt a tinge of regret. A protective group of soldiers would be quite a comfort. The fear of being alone in a strange and dangerous land, even if it was her homeland, was only just below the level of her excitement. It wouldn't take much for the fear to rise over it, and always there was the picture of her father in her mind. Her father in trouble, trapped and alone in the chill waters of death.
"Very well," said Horace. "Sergeant!"
A helmeted head appeared suddenly around the doorway, and Sabriel realized 2 soldiers must have been standing on guard outside the dugout, on the steps up into the communication trench. She wondered if they'd heard.
"Prepare a crossing party," snapped Horace. "A single person to cross? Miss Abhorsen here. And, Sergeant, if you or Private Rahiz so much as talk in your sleep about what you may have heard here, then you'll be on grave-digging fatigues for the rest of your lives." "Yes, sir,"
came the sharp reply, echoed by the unfortunate Private Rahiz, who, Sabriel noted, did seem half asleep.
"After you, please," continued Horace, gesturing towards the door. "May I carry your skis again?"
The army took no chances when it came to crossing the wall. Sabriel stood alone under the great arch of the gate that pierced the wall, but archers stood or knelt in a reverse arrowhead formation around the gate, and a dozen swordsmen had gone ahead with Colonel Horace. 100 yards behind her, past a zigzagged lane of barbed wire, 2 Lewin machine gunners watched from a forward emplacement, though Sabriel noted they had drawn their sword bayonets and thrust them, ready for use, in the sandbags, showing little faith in their air-cooled 45 rounds per minute tools of destruction. There was no actual gate in the archway, though rusting hinges swung like mechanical hands on either side, and sharp shards of oak thrust out of the ground like teeth in a broken jaw, testimony to some explosion of modern chemistry or magical force. It was snowing lightly on the Old Kingdom side, and the wind channeled occasional snowflakes through the gate into Enselstier, where they melted on the warmer ground of the south. One caught in Sabriel's hair. She brushed at it lightly, till it slid down her face and was captured by her tongue. The cold water was refreshing, and, though it tasted no different from any other melted snow she'd drunk, it marked her first taste of the Old Kingdom in 13 years. Dimly, she remembered it had been snowing then. Her father had carried her through when he first brought her south into Enselstier. A whistle alerted her, and she saw a figure appear out of the snow, flanked by 12 others, who drew up in 2 lines leading out from the gate. They faced outwards. Their sword remembered it had been snowing then. Her father had carried her through
when he first brought her south into Anselstier. A whistle alerted her, and she saw a figure appear out of the snow, flanked by 12 others, who drew up in two lines leading out from the gate. They faced outwards, their swords shining, blades reflecting the light that was itself reflected from the snow. Only Horiz looked inwards, waiting for her. With her skis over her shoulder, Sabriel picked her way among the broken timbers of the gate, going through the arch from mud into snow, from bright sun into the pallid luminescence of a snowfall, from her past into her future. The stones of the wall on either side and above her head seemed to call a welcome home, and rivulets of charter marks ran through the stones like rain through dust. "The old kingdom welcomes you," said Horiz, but he was watching the charter marks run on the stones, not looking at Sabriel. Sabriel stepped out of the shadow of the gate and pulled her cap down, so the peak shielded her face against the snow. "I wish your mission every success, Sabriel," continued Horiz, looking back at her. "I hope I see both you and your father before too long." He saluted, turned smartly to his left, and was gone, wheeling around her and marching back through the gate. His men peeled off from the line and followed. Sabriel bent down as they marched past, slid her skis back and forth in the snow, then slipped her boots into the bindings. The snow was falling steadily, but it was only a light fall, and the cover was patchy. She could still easily make out the old north road. Fortunately, the snow had banked up in the gutters to either side of the road, and she could make good time if she kept to these narrow snowways. Even though it seemed to be several hours later in the old kingdom than it was in Anselstier, she expected to reach Cloven Crest before dusk. Taking up her poles, Sabriel checked that her father's sword was easy in its scabbard, and the bells hung properly from their baldric. She considered a quick charter spell for warmth, but decided against it. The road had a slight uphill gradient, so the skiing would be quite hard work. In her hand-knitted greasy wool shirt, leather jerkin, and thick double-padded skiing knickerbockers, she would probably be too warm once she got going. With a practiced motion, she pushed one ski ahead, the opposite arm reaching forward with her pole, and slid forward, just as the last swordsman passed her on his way back through the gate. He grinned as he passed by, but she didn't notice, concentrating on building up the rhythm of her skis and poles. Within minutes, she was practically flying up the road, a slim, dark figure against the white of the ground. Chapter 4. Sabriel found the first dead Anselstieran soldier about 6 miles from the wall in the last fading hours of the afternoon. The hill she thought was Cloven Crest was a mile or two to the north. She'd stopped to look at its dark bulk, rising rocky and treeless from the snow-covered ground, its peak temporarily hidden in one of the light, puffy clouds that occasionally let forth a shower of snow or sleet. If she hadn't stopped, she would probably have missed the frosted white hand that peeked out of a drift on the other side of the road. But as soon as she saw that, her attention focused, and Sabriel felt the familiar pang of death. Crossing over, her skis clacking on bare stone in the middle of the road, she bent down and gently brushed the snow away. The hand belonged to a young man who wore a standard-issue coat of mail over an Anselstieran uniform of khaki serge. He was blonde and grey-eyed, and Sabriel thought he had been surprised, but there was no fear in his frozen expression. She touched his forehead with one finger, closed his sightless eyes, and laid 2 fingers against his open mouth. He had been dead 12 days, she felt. There were no obvious signs as to what had killed him. To learn more than that, she would have to follow the young man into death. even after 12 days, it was unlikely he had gone further than the fourth gate. Even so, Sabriel had a strong disinclination to enter the realm of the dead until she absolutely had to. Whatever had trapped or killed her father could easily be waiting to ambush her there. This dead soldier could even be a lure. Quashing her natural curiosity to find out exactly what had happened, Sabriel folded the man's arms across his chest after first unclenching the grip that his right hand still had on his sword hilt. Perhaps he had not been taken totally unawares after all. Then she stood and drew the charter marks of fire, cleansing, peace, and sleep in the air above the corpse, while whispering the sounds of those same marks. It was a litany that every charter mage knew, and it had the usual effect. A glowing ember sparked up between the man's folded arms, multiplied into many stabbing, darting flames. Then fire whooshed the full length of the body. Seconds later, it was out, and only ash remained. Ash staining a corselet of blackened mail. Sabriel took the soldier's sword from the pile of ashes and thrust it through the melted snow into the dark earth beneath. It stuck fast, upright, the hilt casting a shadow like a cross upon the ashes. Something glinted in the shadow, and belatedly, Sabriel remembered that the soldier would have worn an identity disc, or tag. Shifting her skis again to rebalance, she bent down and hooked the chain of the identity disc on one finger, pulling it up to read the name of the man who had met his end here, alone in the snow. But both the chain and disc were machine-made in Anselstier, and so unable to withstand the charter magic fire. The disc crumbled into ash as Sabriel raised it to eye level, and the chain fell into its component links, pouring between Sabriel's fingers like small steel coins. "Perhaps they'll know you from your sword," said Sabriel. Her voice sounded strange in the quiet of the snowy wilderness, and behind each word her breath rolled out like a small wet fog. "Travel without regret," she added. "Do not look back." Sabriel took her own advice as she skied away. There was an anxiety in her now that had been mostly academic before, and every sense was alert, watchful. She had always been told that the old kingdom was dangerous, and the borderlands near the wall particularly so. But that intellectual knowledge was tempered by her vague childhood memories of happiness, of being with her father and the band of travelers. Now the reality of the danger was slowly coming home. Half a mile on, she slowed and stopped to look up at Cloven Crest again, neck cricked back to watch where the sun struck between the clouds, lighting up the yellow-red granite of the bluffs. She was in cloud shadow herself, so the hill looked like an attractive destination. As she looked, it started to snow again, and two snowflakes fell upon her forehead, melting into her eyes. She blinked, and the melted snow traced tear trails down her cheeks. Through misted eyes, she saw a bird of prey, a hawk or kite, launch itself from the bluffs and hover, its concentration totally centered upon some small mouse or vole creeping across the snow. The kite dropped like a cast stone, and a few seconds later, Sabriel felt some small life snuffed out. At the same time, she also felt the tug of human death. Somewhere ahead, near where the kite dined, more people lay dead. Sabriel shivered and looked at the hill again. According to Horiz's map, the path to Cloven Crest lay in a narrow gully between two bluffs. She could see quite clearly where it must be, but the dead lay in that direction. Whatever had killed them might also still be there. There was sunlight on the bluffs, but the wind was driving snow clouds across the sun, and Sabriel guessed it was only an hour or so till dusk. She'd lost time freeing the soldier's spirit, and now had no choice but to hurry on if she wished to reach Cloven Crest before nightfall. She thought about what lay ahead for a moment, then chose a compromise between speed and caution. Stabbing her poles into the snow, she released her bindings, stepped out of her skis, and then quickly fastened skis and poles together to be strapped diagonally across her backpack. She tied them on carefully, remembering how they'd fallen and broken her charter spell on the parade ground only that morning, but it seemed like weeks ago and a world away. That done, she started to pick her way down the center of the road, keeping away from the gutter drifts. She'd have to leave the road fairly soon, but it looked like there was little snow on the steep, rocky slopes of Cloven Crest. As a final precaution, she drew Abhorsen's sword, then resheathed it, so an inch of blade was free of the scabbard. It would draw fast and easily when she needed it. Sabriel expected to find the bodies on the road or near it, but they lay further on. There were many footprints and churned up snow, leading from the road towards the path to Cloven Crest. That path ran between the bluffs, following a route gouged out by a stream falling from some deep spring higher up the hill. The path crossed the stream several times, with stepping stones or tree trunks across the water to save walkers from wet feet. Halfway up, where the bluffs almost ground together, the stream had dug itself a short gorge, about 12 feet wide, 30 feet long and deep. Here the pathmakers had been forced to build a bridge along the stream, rather than across it. Sabriel found the rest of the Ancelstieran patrol here, tumbled on the dark, olive-black wood of the bridge, with the water murmuring beneath and the red stone arching overhead. There were 7 of them along the bridge's length. Unlike the first soldier, it was quite clear what had killed them. They had been hacked apart, and, as Sabriel edged closer, she realized they had been beheaded. Worse than that, whoever, whatever, had killed them had taken their heads away, almost a guarantee that their spirits would return. Her sword did draw easily. Gingerly, her right hand almost glued to the sword hilt, Sabriel stepped around the first of the splayed-out bodies and onto the bridge. The water beneath was partly iced over, shallow and sluggish, but it was clear the soldiers had sought refuge over it. Running water was a good protection from dead creatures or things of free magic, but this torpid stream would not have dismayed even one of the lesser dead. In spring, fed with melted snow, the stream would burst between the bluffs, and the bridge would be knee-deep in clear, swift water. The soldiers would probably have survived at that time of year. Sabriel sighed quietly, thinking of how easily 7 people could be alive in one instant, and then, despite everything they could do, despite their last hope, they could be dead in just another. Once again she felt the temptation of the necromancer, to take the cards nature had dealt, to reshuffle them, and deal again. She had the power to make these men live again, laugh again, love again, but without their heads, she could only bring them back as hands, a derogatory term that free magic necromancers used for their lackluster revenants, who retained little of their original intelligence and none of their initiative. They made useful servants, though, either as reanimated corpses or the more difficult shadow hands, where only the spirit was brought back. Sabriel grimaced as she thought of shadow hands. A skilled necromancer could easily raise shadow hands from the heads of the newly dead. Similarly, without the heads, she couldn't give them the final rites and free their spirits. All she could do was treat the bodies with some respect, and in the process, clear the bridge. It was near to dusk and dark already in the shadow of the gorge, but she ignored the little voice inside her that was urging her to leave the bodies and run for the open space of the hilltop. By the time she finished dragging the bodies back down the path away, laying them out with their swords plunged in the earth next to their headless bodies, It was dark outside the gorge, too. So dark, she had to risk a faint, charter-conjured light that hung like a pale star above her head, showing the path before dying out. A slight magic, but one with unexpected consequences, for, as she left the bodies behind, an answering light burned into brilliance on the upper post of the bridge. It faded into red embers almost immediately, but left three glowing charter marks. One was strange to Sabriel, but from the other two, she guessed its meaning. Together, they held a message. Three of the dead soldiers had the feel of charter magic about them, and Sabriel guessed that they were charter mages. They would have had the charter mark on their foreheads. The very last body on the bridge had been one of these men, and Sabriel remembered that he had been the only one not holding a weapon. His hands had been clasped around the bridge post. These marks would certainly hold his message. Sabriel touched her own forehead charter mark, and then the bridge post. The marks flared again, then went dark. A voice came from nowhere, close to Sabriel's ear, a man's voice, husky with fear, backed by the sound of clashing weapons, screaming, and total panic.
"One of the greater dead. It came behind us, almost from the wall. We couldn't turn back. It has servants, hands, a mordicant. This is Sergeant Jeren. Tell Colonel..."
Whatever he wanted to tell Colonel Horiz was lost in the moment of his own death. Sabriel stood still, listening, as if there might be more. She felt ill, nauseous, and took several deep breaths. She had forgotten that for all her familiarity with death and the dead, she had never seen or heard anyone actually die. The aftermath she had learnt to deal with, but not the event. She touched the bridge post again, just with one finger, and felt the charter marks twisting through the grain of the wood. Sergeant Jeren's message would be there forever for any charter mage to hear, till time did its work, and bridge post and bridge rotted or were swept away by flood. Sabriel took a few more breaths, stilled her stomach, and forced herself to listen once more. One of the greater dead was back in life, and that was something her father was sworn to stop. It was almost certain that this emergence and Ab Horsin's disappearance were connected. Once again the message came, and Sabriel listened. Then, brushing back her starting tears, she walked on, up the path, away from the bridge and the dead, up towards Cloven Crest and the broken charter stone. The bluffs parted, and, in the sky above, stars started to twinkle as the wind grew braver and swept the snow clouds before it into the west. The new moon unveiled itself and swelled in brightness till it cast shadows on the snow-flecked ground. Chapter 5. It was no more than a half-hour's steady climb to the flat top of Cloven Crest, though the path grew steeper and more difficult. The wind was strong now and had cleared the sky, the moonlight giving form to the landscape, but without the clouds it had grown much colder. Sabriel considered a charter spell for warmth, but she was tired, and the effort of the spell might cost more than the gain in warmth. She stopped instead and shrugged on a fleece-lined oilskin that had been handed down from her father. It was a bit worn and too large, needing severe buckling in with her sword belt and the baldric that held the bells, but it was certainly windproof. Feeling relatively warmer, Sabriel resumed climbing up the last winding portion of the path, where the incline was so steep the pathmakers had resorted to cutting steps out of the granite, steps now worn and crumbling, prone to sliding away underfoot. So prone to sliding that Sabriel reached the top without realizing it, head down, her eyes searching in the moonlight for the solid part of the next step. Her foot was actually halfway up in the air before she realized that there wasn't a next step.
Cloven Crest lay before her, a narrow ridge where several slopes of the hill met to form a miniature plateau with a slight depression in the middle. Snow lay in this depression, a fat, cigar-shaped drift, bright in the moonlight, stark white against the red granite. There were no trees, no vegetation at all, but in the very center of the drift, a dark grey stone cast a long moon shadow. It was twice Sabriel's girth, and three times her height, and looked whole till she walked closer and saw the zigzag crack that cut it down the middle. Sabriel had never seen a true charter stone before, but she knew they were supposed to be like the wall, with charter marks running like quicksilver through the stone, forming and dissolving, only to reform again in a never-ending story that told of the making of the world. There were charter marks on this stone, but they were still, as frozen as the snow. Dead marks. Nothing more than meaningless inscriptions carved into a sculptured stone. It wasn't what Sabriel had expected, though she now realized that she hadn't thought about it properly. She thought of lightning or such like as the splitter of the stone, but forgotten lessons remembered too late told her that wasn't so. Only some terrible power of free magic could split a charter stone. She walked closer to the stone, fear rising in her like a toothache in its first growth, signaling worse to come. The wind was stronger and colder, too, out on the ridge, and the oilskin seemed less comforting, as its memories of her father brought back remembrance of certain pages of the Book of the Dead, and tales of horror told by little girls in the darkness of their dormitory, far from the old kingdom. Fears came with these memories, till Sabriel wrestled them to the back of her mind and forced herself closer to the stone. Dark patches of something obscured some of the marks, but it wasn't until Sabriel pushed her face almost to the stone that she could make out what they were, so dull and black in the moonlight. When she did see, her head snapped up, and she stumbled backwards, almost overbalancing into the snow. The patches were dried blood, and when she saw them, Sabriel knew how the stone had been broken, and why the blood hadn't been cleaned away by rain or snow. Why the stone never would be clean. A charter mage had been sacrificed on the stone. Sacrificed by a necromancer to gain access to death, or to help a dead spirit break through into life. Sabriel bit her lower lip till it hurt, and her hands, almost unconsciously, fidgeted, half-drawing charter marks in nervousness and fear. The spell for that sort of sacrifice was in the last chapter of the Book of the Dead. She remembered it now, in sickening detail. It was one of the many things she seemed to have forgotten from that green-bound book, or had been made to forget. Only a very powerful necromancer could use that spell. Only a totally evil one would want to. And evil breeds evil. Evil taints places, and makes them attractive to further acts of... "Stop it," whispered Sabriel aloud, to still her mind of its imaginings. It was dark, windy, and getting colder by the minute. She had to make a decision, to camp and call her guide, or to move on immediately in some random direction, in the hope that she would be able to summon her guide from somewhere else. The worst part of it all was that her guide was dead. Sabriel had to enter death, albeit briefly, to call and converse with the guide. It would be easy to do so here, for the sacrifice had created a semi-permanent entry, as if a door had been wedged ajar. But who knew what might be lurking, watching, in the cold river beyond. Sabriel stood for a minute, shivering, listening, every sense concentrated, like some small animal that knows a predator hunts nearby. Her mind ran through the pages of the Book of the Dead, and through the many hours she had spent learning charter magic from Magistrix Greenwood in the sunny North Tower of Wyverley College. At the end of the minute, she knew that camping was out of the question. She was simply too frightened to sleep anywhere near the ruined Charterstone. But it would be quicker to call her guide here. And the quicker she got to her father's house, the sooner she could do something to help him. So a compromise was called for. She would protect herself with charter magic as best she could. Enter death with all precaution. Summon her guide, get directions, and get out as quickly as possible. Quicker, even. With decision came action. Sabriel dropped her skis and pack, stuffed some dried fruit and homemade toffee in her mouth for quick energy, and adopted the meditative pose that made charter magic easier. After a bit of trouble with the toffee and her teeth, she began. Symbols formed in her mind. The four cardinal charter marks that were the poles of a diamond that would protect her from both physical harm and free magic. Sabriel held them in her mind, fixed them in time, and pulled them out of the flow of the never-ending charter. Then, drawing her sword, she traced rough outlines in the snow around her, one mark at each cardinal point of the compass. As she finished each mark, she let the one in her mind run from her head to her hand, down the sword and into the snow. There they ran like lines of golden fire, and the marks became alive, burning on the ground. The last mark was the north mark, the one closest to the destroyed stone, and it almost failed. Sabriel had to close her eyes and use all her will to force it to leave the sword. Even then, it was only a pallid imitation of the other three, burning so weakly it hardly melted the snow. Sabriel ignored it, quelling the nausea that had brought bile to the back of her mouth, her body reacting to the struggle with the charter mark. She knew the north mark was weak, but golden lines had run between all four points, and the diamond was complete, if shaky. In any case, it was the best she could do. She sheathed her sword, took off her gloves, and fumbled with her bell bandolier, cold fingers counting the bells. "Rana," she said aloud, touching the first, the smallest bell. Rana, the sleep-bringer, the sweet low sound that brought silence in its wake. "Mosrael," the second bell, a harsh, rowdy bell. Mosrael was the waker, the bell Sabriel should never use, the bell whose sound was a seesaw, throwing the ringer further into death, as it brought the listener into life. Kibeth, Kibeth the walker, a bell of several sounds, a difficult and contrary bell. It could give freedom of movement to one of the dead, or walk them through the next gate. Many a necromancer had stumbled with Kibeth, and walked where they would not. Dairim, a musical bell, of clear and pretty tone. Dairim was the voice that the dead so often lost. But Dairim could also still a tongue that moved too freely. Belgaer, another tricksome bell, that sought to ring of its own accord. Belgaer was the thinking bell, the bell most necromancers scorned to use. It could restore independent thought, memory, and all the patterns of a living person. Or, slipping in a careless hand, erased them. Saraneth, the deepest, lowest bell, the sound of strength. Saraneth was the binder, the bell that shackled the dead to the wielder's will. And last, the largest bell, the one Sabriel's cold fingers found colder still, even in the leather case that kept it silent. Astarael, the sorrowful, whispered Sabriel. Astarael was the banisher, the final bell. Properly rung, it cast everyone who heard it far into death. Everyone, including the ringer. Sabriel's hand hovered, touched on Rana, and then settled on Saraneth. Carefully, she undid the strap and withdrew the bell. Its clapper, freed of the mask, rang slightly, like the growl of a waking bear. Sabriel stilled it, holding the clapper with her palm inside the bell, ignoring the handle. With her right hand, she drew her sword and raised it to the guard position. Charter marks along the blade caught the moonlight and flickered into life. Sabriel watched them for a moment, as portents could sometimes be seen in such things. Strange marks raced across the blade, before transmuting into the more usual inscription, one that Sabriel knew well. She bowed her head and prepared to enter into death. Unseen by Sabriel, the inscription began again, but parts of it were not the same. "I was made for Abhorsen, to slay those already dead," was what it usually said. Now it continued, "The Clare saw me, the Wallmaker made me, the King quenched me, Abhorsen wields me." Sabriel, eyes closed now, felt the boundary between life and death appear. On her back, she felt the wind now curiously warm, and the moonlight bright and hot like sunshine. On her face, she felt the ultimate cold, and, opening her eyes, saw the grey light of death. With an effort of will, her spirit stepped through, sword and bell prepared. Inside the diamond, her body stiffened, and fog blew up in eddies around her feet, twining up her legs. Frost rimed her face and hands, and the charter marks flared at each apex of the diamond. Three steadied again, but the north mark blazed brighter still and went out. The river ran swiftly, but Sabriel set her feet against the current and ignored both it and the cold, concentrating on looking around, alert for a trap or ambush. It was quiet at this particular entry point to death. She could hear the water tumbling through the second gate, but nothing else. No splashing, or gurgling, or strange mewlings. No dark, formless shapes or grim silhouettes, shadowy in this grey light. Carefully holding her position, Sabriel looked all around her again, before sheathing her sword and reaching into one of the thigh pockets in her woolen knickerbockers. The bell, Saraneth, stayed ready in her left hand. With her right, she drew out a paper boat, and still one-handed, opened it out to its proper shape. Beautifully white, almost luminous in this light, it had one small, perfectly round stain at its bow, where Sabriel had carefully blotted a drop of blood from her finger. Sabriel laid it flat on her hand, lifted it to her lips, and blew on it, as if she were launching a feather. Like a glider, it flew from her hand into the river. Sabriel held that launching breath as the boat was almost swamped, only to breathe in with relief as it breasted a ripple, righted itself, and surged away with the current. In a few seconds it was out of sight, heading for the second gate. It was the second time in her life that Sabriel had launched just such a paper boat. Her father had shown her how to make them, but had impressed on her to use them sparingly. No more than thrice every 7 years, he had said, or a price would have to be paid. A price much greater than a drop of blood. As events should follow, as they had the first time, Sabriel knew what to expect. Still, when the noise of the second gate stilled for a moment, some 10 or 20 or 40 minutes later, time being slippery in death, she drew her sword, and Saraneth hung down in her hand, its clapper free, waiting to be heard. The gate had stilled, because someone, something, was coming back from the deeper realms of death. Sabriel hoped it was the one she had invited with the paper boat. Chapter 6. Charter magic on Cloven Crest. It was like a scent on the wind to the thing that lurked in the caves below the hill, some mile or more to the west of the broken charter stone. It had been human once, or human-like at least, in the years it had lived under the sun. That humanity had been lost in the centuries the thing spent in the chill waters of death, ferociously holding its own against the current, demonstrating an incredible will to live again. A will it didn't know it possessed before a badly cast hunting spear bounced from a rock and clipped its throat. just enough for a last few minutes of frantic life. By sheer effort of will, it had held itself on the life side of the fourth gate for 300 years, growing in power, learning the ways of death. It preyed on lesser spirits and served or avoided greater ones. Always, the thing held on to life. Its chance finally came when a mighty spirit erupted from beyond the seventh gate, smashing through each of the upper gates in turn till it went ravening into life. Hundreds of the dead had followed, and this particular spirit had joined the throng. There had been terrible confusion, and a mighty enemy at the very border between life and death, but in the melee, it had managed to sneak around the edges and squirm triumphantly into life. There were plenty of recently vacated bodies where it emerged, so the thing occupied one, animated it, and ran away. Soon after, it found the caves it now inhabited. It even decided to give itself a name. Thralk. A simple name, not too difficult for a partially decomposed mouth to voice. A male name. Thralk could not remember what its original sex had been those centuries before, but its new body was male. It was a name to instill fear in the few small settlements that still existed in this area of the borderlands, settlements Thralk preyed upon, capturing and consuming the human life he needed to keep himself on the living side of death. Charter magic flared on Cloven Crest again, and Thralk sensed that it was strong and pure, but weakly cast. The strength of the magic scared him, but the lack of skill behind it was reassuring, and strong magic meant a strong life. Thralk needed that life, needed it to shore up the body he used, needed it to replenish the leakage of his spirit back into death. Greed won over fear. The dead thing left the mouth of the cave and started climbing the hill, his lidless, rotting eyes fixed on the distant crest. Sabriel saw her guide first as a tall, pale light drifting over the swirling water towards her, and then, as it stopped several yards away, as a blurred, glowing human shape, its arms outstretched in welcome.
Sabriel.
The words were fuzzy and seemed to come from much farther away than where the shining figure stood. But Sabriel smiled as she felt the warmth in the greeting. Ab Horsen had never explained who or what this luminous person was, but Sabriel thought she knew. She'd summoned this advisor only once before, when she'd first menstruated. There was minimal sex education at Wyverly College, none at all till you were 15. The older girl's stories about menstruation were many, varied, and often meant to scare. None of Sabriel's friends had reached puberty before her, so in fear and desperation, she had entered death. Her father had told her that the one the paperboat summoned would answer any question and would protect her. And so it had. The glowing spirit answered all her questions, and many more besides, till Sabriel was forced to return to life.
"Hello, Mother," said Sabriel, sheathing her sword and carefully muffling Saraneth with her fingers inside the bell.
The shining shape didn't answer, but that wasn't unexpected. Apart from her one-word greeting, she could only answer questions. Sabriel wasn't really sure if the manifestation was the very unusual dead spirit of her mother, which was unlikely, or some residual protective magic left by her.
"I don't have much time," Sabriel continued. "I'd love to ask about, oh, everything, I guess. But at the moment I need to know how to get to Father's house from Cloven Crest. I mean, Barhedron Ridge."
The sending nodded and spoke. As Sabriel listened, she also saw pictures in her head of what the woman was describing. Vivid images, like memories of a journey she'd taken herself.
"Go to the northern side of the ridge. Follow the spur that begins there, down till it reaches the valley floor.
Look at the sky. There won't be any cloud. Look to the bright red star, Euallus, near the horizon, 3 fingers east of north.